Hello and welcome to another episode of Bank FinTech Fusion. This is Philip Ryan, Director of Communications with CCG Catalyst. And I'm here today at Money 2020 with Chris Reed, who is Executive Vice President of North America Services at MasterCard. Welcome, Chris.
You're welcome.
So what drew you to financial services? Was there a particular problem that you set out to solve? Was there a particular point of interest that, brought you to the space?
Well, if you think about how important and integral to all of our lives financial services and payments, whether it's saving, whether it's spending, is for all of us, I just think it's fascinating, the opportunity. So when I joined MasterCard, which was about 12 years ago, we had significant opportunities. I'd worked for a bank. I'd actually worked in retail services as well. So I've always worked in a services orientation. And I think what draws me is how do you solve the problems? How do you create value for consumers? So that's what drew me to this.
And what would you say is the greatest lesson that you've learned in your career? And it can be before financial services, before MasterCard, anywhere along the way.
So that's a good one. I don't think this one is time-bound, actually. Always keep learning. Never stop admitting that you don't know everything, and never stop trying to understand things better than you do today. And I think the world is changing so dynamically, I'm not sure how you operate if you think that you know everything that you need to do.
So how do you keep learning in your day-to-day work at MasterCard?
Well, I try to ask more than I tell. So that's just a value that I've had for a long period of time, which is in meetings, I should probably do more listening than I do talking. I read a lot of dull books. If you ask my wife, my nightstand is full of significantly duller books than hers. And I catch up when I travel on reading. I'm to a certain extent, I'm a Luddite. I carry a lot of paper with me of things that I know would be interesting, fascinating. I might need to know, I might not need to know. And in my travels, I'll just get it out of my bag and plow through it.
In the same way, I love the paper books, nothing quite like it. What is the greatest challenge facing MasterCard right now? I know your CEO has said that it's the war on cash, but from your perspective, what's the biggest challenge you face?
That's a good question. I think the evolution of that is a world beyond cash. I think I think people took it the wrong way where people thought, hey, you're just trying to do away with cash. And we believe cash has a purpose, has a place. We just believe that electronic payments happens to be a simpler way to pay, a smarter and a safer way to play. I'm not sure whether I would say our environment is full of challenges. I actually think maybe the challenge is the enormous breadth of opportunities that we have. As you mentioned, we're here at Money 2020. If you think about the things that we're talking about in this room and then at a different venue in Las Vegas, we're talking about non-card payments. We're talking about account-to-account payments. We're talking about beer delivery drivers being paid on delivery. We're talking about cybersecurity. We're talking about healthcare. We're talking about payment gateway. We're talking about blockchain yesterday and provenance of fish. So I think that talks to the breadth of opportunity. Again, if you go back to commerce and payments and the ways that we can add value to our customer set, and that's both our existing traditional customer set, but it is also, it's the smaller fintechs that are up and coming. It's the packaged goods firms that are up and coming. It's the retailers that we can add way more value than we ever did. So I think our challenge is, how do we ensure that we focus on excellent delivery? How do we focus on a great customer experience, our customers, with an endpoint in mind, which is a great consumer experience or a great small business experience or a great large corporate experience? So always having that focus on rigorous execution, making sure we're doing everything we should be doing with our customer set, is probably just where we spend a lot of our time on in terms of challenges.
So we're going to be talking a little more about cybersecurity as we go on, but there is a number of cybersecurity startups here at Money 2020. And I'm sure they're all anxious to talk to MasterCard. How do you view this vast landscape of companies that are looking to work with you?
I look at them welcomingly. I think cybersecurity is an area that actually, as an industry, you find natural collaboration, you find natural points of interest. We may come at it different way, we might have slightly different solution flavors, but we have a collective both need and interest in making sure that our ecosystem is designed with security at its heart. We learn a lot from these smaller companies. It's no secret, we bought a fantastic company called Nudata, which was a fintech cyber company a couple of years ago based out of Vancouver. We bought an AI company around the same time that was focused on fraud at scale analytics. And we were incredibly fortunate to be able to buy Ethoca, which plays in not necessarily cybersecurity, but plays in just that rapid transfer of data between all the participants to make our environment more secure and arguably to stop fraud in its tracks. So we love talking to the smaller players. We have a few of them actually in our Start Path FinTech Accelerator program. So not just talk to them, we actually look to create real value for some of them, either integrating into our solutions or introducing to them to our partners in the broader space where they can also just grow and learn at the same time.
And that's a huge global program, Start Path. Yeah.
Yeah, Start Path is, I think we've had Start Path for 5 or 6 years. And it just gets better every year. Our customers tell us that actually what our traditional customers most value is us curating brilliant small companies that are solving problems that they just can't get to. And the startups just love being able to get that immediate access. So this is one where it works for us, it works for our customers, and it works for fintech. So I don't see it stopping, I just see it expanding.
What would you say is the key for financial institutions and fintech players to successfully working together?
I think there's a few things. If you go back maybe 5 years ago, you wouldn't be able to read about banks and fintechs without the editorial commentary being, oh, fintechs are going to put banks out of business, or, you know, banks, it's the next big threat on the horizon. And I think the lovely thing that we're now seeing is actually there's more than a happy coexistence, that both are gaining real value out of the ecosystem. So I think that's the first thing to say, is just this acceptance, this embrace that actually this is a really good thing for the payments ecosystem. Then I would say, be clear around what both parties are looking to get out of working together. For sure, there's value in exploratory conversations, but everybody has limited resources, not least the fintech. I think it therefore is just incumbent on both parties to say, do we have a vision to solve the same problem? And if we do, great. Do we have assets that come together like a jigsaw as opposed to them being competing or very similar? And then I think it can be phenomenally successful. That's where I see it working best, is where a fintech fits a need, fills a gap, creates value for the traditional financial institution in a way that they would probably have gotten to, but they might have struggled to have gotten to, or it would have been a trade-off. So I think that's a secret.
Which currently developing technology, or maybe not yet mature technology, are you most excited about? Do you think will have the most impact on your space?
Now that's a hard question, because I'm not sure there is one in and of itself. I think in the security space, I get unusually excited about what tokenization is going to do for digital commerce and online payments. I think taking out of our system the transfer of the real 16-digit card details is going to be as transformative as putting a chip on the physical card will be. And we've seen as an industry what that has done in terms of securing the physical commerce environment. So I get Excited will be a sad word to say, but I'm hugely enthusiastic about the promise of that, because I think that will be critical both to consumers feeling that when they shop online that things are safe, but also just merchants trying to do what they want to do, which is take payments, and banks having a level of security. I think we'll see more transactions being accepted first time around. And I think that will be critical in delivering the ultimate moment of truth, which is somebody's looking to buy something. Then if I think about customer experience, I do think digital and device-based commerce and environments are where innovation is going to happen. It's where consumers are going to want not just to shop, but they're going to want to interact with the companies that they're most fond of. So whether that's looking at a statement, being able to identify payments, or whether that's actually being able to use their device to pay with something using their reward points on Pay with Rewards, I think those are the two primary things that I think over the next 5 years will secure our ecosystem to further nurture trust and deliver great customer experiences.
You talked about not disappearance maybe, but the lessening importance of the 16-digit PAN. And we're already seeing that a bit with the Apple Card, aren't we? It's not readily apparent. People who talk about tokenization often say they're excited. I think people who are into tokenization are really love it. And nothing wrong with that. But do you think the 16-digit PAN is going to go away? Is it just going to maybe recede from view and always be the kind of foundation of payments?
I agree with you. I think the 16-digit PAN is necessary in terms of being able to ensure that the transaction flow and the data begins in the right spot and ends in the right spot. But I think what we've proven is it doesn't need to be within the data flow and within the transaction stream. And that's where any data, when it's moving, has a greater element of risk. So if you can take risk out of that system, if you can effectively tell the fraudsters, you may get access to it, but it's going to be worthless because it's a token, it's encrypted, then while it won't put them out of business, it will make sure everybody will have more confidence in the data coming through. So I don't see 16-digit PAN numbers, the account numbers, going away in the short or medium term. I think they're necessary, and as more people take electronic payments and more use cases are found, we're always going to need to tie that back to an individual. But tokenization will just, I think you said it, it will recede into the distance. SRC should enable that experience of having to type it in online to go away. So we're just actively looking to drive great consumer experience and enhance security, and tokenization does it.
I think younger people are going to think it's absurd in a few years that we might recite our 16-digit yes. number on the phone to yeah. order a pizza.
I agree. Yeah.
So consumer acceptance of mobile wallets appears to be on the rise. And again, I think the Apple Card is playing as big a role as anything in this. What implications does this have for the security of payments down the line?
Well, I think what we see in those environments is those environments are architected and created with phenomenal security at its core and in its foundation and architecture. The partners that we work with, they were as adamant as we were that they wanted this environment to be as secure as possible. So I think mobile wallets will always drive security. I think they'll take advantage and can take advantage of the latest technology in that regard. And so I only see it advancing the cause on security and technology. I don't think it will become too far distant from security everywhere. I think we've got to lock every form factor to the extent that we can. I think what's driving consumer adoption is it's delivering really good user experiences in some regards. And, you know, it's what I was saying about financial services, is you're solving consumer problems. If they find it an easier way to pay and it's secure, they will use it. And that's a lovely thing about our industry, is we're enabling multiple ways for people to pay, and they're taking advantage of it.
What does it mean that we rely on handset manufacturers for security? You know, Touch ID and now Face ID. Is that always going to be a vital part of the security, of the sort of value chain or of the security ecosystem?
Look, I think what you're talking about there is biometrics, which is, I think everybody would agree, is a much more secure way to validate yourself. Who you are is truly individual as opposed to what you know in the form of a password or what you have in the form of, say, a token device that gives you a number. So the first thing I would say is I am completely in favor and a big proponent of biometrics being the right way to authenticate yourself in an online environment. And I think it's an advantage of the device manufacturers and the security that is going into those devices that they enable multiple ways for people to authenticate themselves. And at the end of the day, companies have a choice in terms of whether they want to use it. Some companies are doing voice biometrics. So if they don't, for whatever reason, want to rely or want to use on device-based biometrics, that's fine because there's voice-based biometrics that they can use and to a certain extent they can be in control of. So again, for me, it's about optionality, but I do believe biometrics is the way that we should collectively be going in terms of ensuring that Chris Reed is Chris Reed because you can prove it's me.
So final question, do you think biometrics is the key to digital identity, assuming down the line we have some sort of lasting form of digital identity? This, of course, is being done in India, I think, has a national identity system where we seem unlikely to come up with something like that in the United States for a variety of reasons. But do you think biometrics is the base of that? Or
I think it's an ingredient in it. I mean, digital identity takes many formats. I would say biometrics right now is, in its broadest form, is the most secure way in a remote environment to be able to prove that you are who you say you are. Fingerprint, facial recognition, or voice. I think there are more ingredients in digital identity in terms of a broader spectrum of ways that you can prove who you are, whether that's the device that you're using, how you're using the device. You get active biometrics in, say, facial recognition. And that's fine. That's a very active process for a customer. But again, Nudata, the company I was telling you we bought a couple of years ago, they're world-class at passive biometrics. So actually, without interrupting what the customer is trying to do, it can tell that Chris is Chris in terms of how I'm holding the phone. Am I holding it with my right hand? Am I typing it with two thumbs? Do I have it in my pocket? When actually it looks like someone's using it, so someone might have spoofed my device. So I think biometrics is going to be an ingredient in digital identity, but I don't think it's going to be the sole ingredient.
Chris, thanks so much. I appreciate the time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.